Analyzing now. Stand clear.
Goeiedag en welkom allemaal terug bij een extra aflevering van onze Spoedcast. Ik ben nog altijd Cedric van Dijk en vandaag neem ik jullie mee naar de andere kant van de wereld, meer bepaald naar de stad Seattle in de staat Washington in de Verenigde Staten van Amerika. In de USA zitten we natuurlijk met een heel andere populatie van patiënten. We zien bijvoorbeeld veel meer trauma, vooral dan penetrerend trauma zoals schotwonden, maar ook steekwonden. En ook de afstanden tot het traumacentrum zijn veel groter dan bijvoorbeeld wij in West-Europa zien. Laat dat het ideaal recept zijn om een luchtreddingsdienst te creëren natuurlijk. Aan de University of Washington hebben ze dat dan ook gedaan, al heel lang geleden. En dat is Airlift Northwest, bestaande uit een heel aantal vliegtuigen en helikopters in de regio. En ik heb er ook zelf 2 jaar als luchtreddingsarts gewerkt. Het is natuurlijk een universitaire of een academische luchtreddingsdienst die graag innoveert en dus ook met de nieuwste technologieën van start gaat. En zo is dat ook gebeurd met het gebruik van prehospitaal bloedproducten en dus prehospitaal transfusie. En ik heb vandaag afgesproken met Rich Urnachit en Andrew Latimer, mijn oude collega's prehospitaalartsen, die ook de medische directie van de luchtreddingsdienst voor zich nemen. En ik heb ze een keer gevraagd hoe dat juist allemaal in zijn werk is gegaan met die prehospitaal transfusie. All right, hello. This is Cedric van Dijk. You guys already know me from our Dutch-speaking podcasts, and I'm here at Boeing Field in Seattle, Washington, United States of America, in the office with Rich Urnachit and Andrew Latimer. Rich and Andrew are flight physicians, and they're in the lead at Airlift Northwest, which is a helicopter and air rescue service. But I will let them introduce their own service. So why don't you guys go ahead?
Hello, my name is Richard Urnachit. I am the medical director for Airlift Northwest. I'm also faculty in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Washington and core faculty in the section of EMS. And as Cedric said, I'm also one of the serve as a flight physician with Airlift as well.
And I'm Andrew Latimer, the Associate Medical Director for Airlift Northwest. I'm also emergency medicine faculty here at the University of Washington at Harborview Medical Center and the Associate Program Director for our EMS Medicine Pre-Hospital Care Fellowship for Physicians here in Seattle.
All right. Well, guys, first of all, great to see you again. It's been a while because it was about 2 years ago that I passed through Airlift Northwest as a flight physician during my fellowship here at the University of Washington. So it is great to see you again. I can see that the company's never ceased to grow, so that's good news. One of the things that Airlift has always done, in my opinion at least, is be very innovative, use new techniques. And one of those techniques that may not be as new to you guys anymore, because you've been using it for a while, is pre-hospital blood transfusion. So if it's okay with you, I would like to talk a little bit about that subject and get you guys' experience on that topic. So when did you guys first talk about implementing blood products with Airlift Northwest?
I could fill you in on that since I was here when that started. So when I looked at my emails, I can trace it back to March of 2014, when I got an email from, or a call actually, from the chief of trauma at Harborview, Dr. Eileen Bulger, who basically said, hey, why don't we carry blood and Airlift? And I was like, that's a great idea. Let's go ahead and do that. So around 5 o'clock that night, I basically sat with my lead educator at the time and said, let's come up with a protocol to do this. So we basically looked around and cobbled together our own sort of policy and procedure from existing programs out there. I think we used our initial protocol we took from Houston, I believe, from John Holcomb's program there. And then from there, it took several months after that as we were putting together the final policy procedure. And at that point, we wanted to do it just at one base. At that time, I think we had 6 bases here in Washington, just to make sure that we, you know, could basically perform it well. And it was basically here at the Seattle base at the time. At the time, we had a helicopter based out of here. But it wasn't probably until that next year, around 2015, is when we actually started carry blood products on at least one of our at our one base here in Seattle, where we had a helicopter based out of. So the first base that had it was the Seattle base at the time, and it was basically here until we expanded it to other bases as the years kind of progressed, to the point now we have it at every single base. We carry blood products, and we carry 2 units of Packard blood cells and 2 units of liquid plasma on every transport, fixed wing and rotary.
Yeah. Can you talk us a little bit through the logistics of that operation and those blood products?
Yeah, great question. So it can be a little challenging just because we have a big geographically disparate program, right? So for those of you guys listening in at home, Airlift Northwest, so the state of Washington's a big state in the United States geographically, and we have currently eight bases in the state of Washington, 4 on the west side, sort of in more urban, suburban, metropolitan proximate areas that are within 45 minutes to an hour and a half of major cities. But on the east side of the state, we have some pretty remote areas that we have to get these blood products to. And then in southeast Alaska, in Juneau, Alaska, we have a base that also has blood products. So logistics of this is pretty hard. We have a very conservative blood bank. And in our blood bank system, the director, who's been very supportive of us, wants all the blood products back within 7 days. So we'll take the blood out, we'll keep it at the bases, we'll use it on our flights. If the blood products don't get transfused in a week, we then will actually cycle them back into the blood bank to get used. So the whole idea is a zero waste system. First couple of years, we had a little bit of waste just with some logistical errors, but we essentially haven't wasted a unit of blood product in a year and a half, 2 years, my understanding, at least. So we've been pretty efficient with this. We do this largely with keeping track of this. On when the crews come in during the daytime, they find out how many days they have left on the blood. If they're at day 6 or definitely day 7 of the blood products, they'll actually take it with them. And if they get close to Harborview, where our blood bank is situated, they'll cycle the blood out on the day of. So they'll request a little bit extra sort of out of service time. They'll notify the blood bank ideally 30 minutes before arrival so they can get the Credo coolers that we use primed and ready to go. And they'll just get fresh blood. They'll hand over the old blood coolers. And they're good to go. If they're not able to make it back to Harborview, so most of our Western Washington aircraft make it to Harborview frequently enough, that's typically how they cycle the blood. On the east side of the state, we actually use couriers. So we use a courier system. We have a contract with a private ambulance company that helps us with some of our stocking. And this courier sort of will go and do these transports when they're needed, when blood hasn't been switched out. So we keep track of this, and the courier will essentially pick up the blood in this specialized crate that essentially simulates a refrigerator, so it doesn't count as sort of out of blood bank cool time, despite the fact that these are Credo boxes that we utilize are inside of this, and they'll drive them to the base, hand over the new blood, take the old blood, put it in the cooler, and drive it back to Harborview. So it's sort of a whole day activity. We're still in the process of some of the logistics with our Eastern Washington base about getting this to Spokane, which also has a very busy level 2 trauma center with a blood bank, and we're hopeful to partner with them in the future. Juneau is a whole separate beast, and we end up actually utilizing a contract with Alaska Airlines, one of the U.S. domestic airlines, to give us essentially a discounted freight rate, and they do this as sort of part of their service to the people of southeastern Alaska, which has been great. I keep mentioning the Credo box, and I recognize that may not be a
yeah,
familiar
but
term.
No, maybe we should explain a little bit. How is the blood kept at the base, and how is it transported in the aircraft?
So at the bases and transport in the aircraft itself, the blood products are kept in something called a Credo box. It's basically, trying to think the size of it wise. It's about
like a lunch cooler, maybe?
Yeah, it's kind of like a, almost
you send
like
your kids to lunch with?
Yeah, a lunch cooler size container that it's actually lined with deuterium. Deuterium, is that right?
Deuterium ice.
Heavy water, yeah, right?
Exactly.
And it basically, it's it'll help keep the interior temperature at a constant temperature, basically. And we actually have sensors inside of each container, so we can actually track with some granularity whether or not the blood products have gone out of temperature range. Usually, we keep it between 1 degrees to 6 degrees Celsius. When it's not being used on a mission, it's basically stored in a refrigerator at the base itself. And then each time the blood is removed when you go on mission, and we basically take it for every mission, the time is noted so that we know how long that blood has been outside of any refrigerator, and then we keep tabs on that. And if it's out longer than or getting close to 24 hours outside of fridge time, we circle it back to the Harborview main deep freezer at the trauma center. So either 24 hours outside of a refrigerator, or in total 7 days outside of the main deep freezer from at the trauma center, is kind of like the time frame that we get the blood cycled back. And this even includes Southeast Alaska. So the logistical
dance.
Efforts, yeah, yeah. The dance is probably the best way to put it, is fairly significant. But again, it's something that we've been doing now for several years.
These deuterium ice Credo coolers. And Credo is a brand. We don't have any specific attraction. You know, we obviously don't have any conflicts with this company. But they're small enough. They have straps on them. They're fairly durable. And when we go on a mission, we'll just literally throw them in the aircraft and use some carabiners and strap them down so they don't hit us in the face if there's turbulence. And we do the same for our fixed-wing missions. For the really long fixed-wing missions, if we can think about it, the crew will actually bring a larger, in the Learjet, for example, out of Juneau, they'll bring a larger sort of storage crate that has more ice inside of it, and that will extend the out-of-fridge time so that mm-hmm. if the crew knows they're going to get stuck someplace, they can use these boxes for transport. And the blood bank has been supportive of that. It doesn't sort of count as out of fridge time.
Actually, gets a little too cold sometimes when you look at it. Like sometimes it actually got colder in these, like, you know, larger containers. So, it actually works too well sometimes.
Yeah.
And to clarify, so within that Credo box, you carry 2 units of packed red blood cells and 2 units of liquid plasma. Obviously, we have a couple of logistical challenges as well, and so mostly it's fresh frozen plasma in a frozen status that is used. So liquid plasma, to be clear.
Yes.
Correct. And it is a plasma, A type.
Okay. All right. Good. So I think that covers logistics, which is a whole operation, as you guys described. Do you guys have any idea for whom this blood is used in the air?
I mean, for the most part, it ends up being for trauma patients with suspected hemorrhagic shock. When you look at the patients that we transfuse, that's about, I would say, 85% of the time, that is the reason why we're transfusing, is for trauma patients with suspected hemorrhagic shock. The other sort of smattering of patients are, you know, massive GI bleed, postpartum OB type hemorrhage, things like that. But for the most part, it's for trauma. As far as the number of transfusions, I think that may have been one of your questions. As far as mm-hmm. how many we transfuse in a given year, we'll transfuse anywhere from like 110 to 125 or so patients. We actually crack the box open for patients. So basically, you know, when does the crew make a decision, or how often does the crew make a decision to actually start our own blood products? It's about that much, and you know, it's about 120 patients a year, I think, is probably a rough number that we'll end up transfusing.
What total flight volume is that?
We did 4,400 flights last year, and that was the busiest year the program's had in decades.
Right.
But I would say over the life of the blood product transfusion, somewhere between 3,500 to 4,000, I think, is probably a reasonable average flight year.
Yeah, except probably for the year that I was here, because it was COVID.
right. Everyone's inside. Yeah. Exactly.
On that note, I think we've had a couple of really dramatic obstetrical hemorrhage cases that the blood was clearly life-saving, especially from rural parts of the Pacific Northwest, which, you know, gets rural and far from major centers quickly. I got a call even over the weekend. Occasionally we'll give the liquid plasma a benefit of having just liquid plasma for coagulopathy. So we transported a patient with an elevated INR with a significant intraparenchymal hemorrhage that came from a facility where they didn't have access to K-Centra or any...
PCC.
So they ended up giving just 2 units of liquid plasma and transport to help with INR reversal. So occasionally things like that will come up.
Okay. Yeah. How do you... do you guys have any scientific output on the blood products you use from Airlift Northwest?
I was going to say, you were part of that project.
I know.
That's why I asked. We don't have big data on the majority. So basically, we did look at this a few years ago in a paper that Cedric actually was lead author for, looking at this in pediatric patients.
Trying to find the paper right here.
Exactly. You know, we're in the process currently of being involved in. Actually, we have a publication that's just very close to completion, looking at outcomes in trauma patients who receive blood products. So more to come on that, and then we're also part of a multi-center randomized trial that's actually out of Pittsburgh called the Two War Study, looking at whole blood versus component therapy. So that's a study which is ongoing. Mm-hmm. So some of our aircraft actually will actually carry our component therapy, which is standard therapy, and then also whole blood.
An extra credo box. Yeah. So if the patient meets candidacy for this trial, and this is many of you listening in, and Cedric, you may be familiar with the PAMPER trial. It came out of Pittsburgh, an air medical trial that showed a survival benefit to pre-hospital plasma. And really interestingly, in that study, some of the big endpoints were patients who had longer transport times, and really the inflection point seemed to be kind of 30 to 40 minutes. They were the biggest benefit. And then patients with severe traumatic brain injury seemed to benefit the most from plasma. So those were sort of the two groups that benefited the most. They did a really nice job, and we've been begging to work with this group for a long time, and they invited us to the party this time. So we are currently enrolling with the Stat Medevac folks out of Pittsburgh, working with that group. Mayo folks are working with this, Houston as well. So we're pretty excited. But occasionally, if a patient meets candidacy for the Two War Trial, pretty bad acronym.
Yeah, it's terrible.
typo, whole blood, and age and resuscitation trial. So we call it the Tower Trial just because most of the nurses can't stomach saying the two war. but it's Department of Defense funded.
All right. Well, so it's interesting that you mentioned that the infliction point is kind of around 30 to 40 minutes, because in Belgium, we usually have shorter transport times with road transportation, which are about 10 to 20 minutes. Do you think there's any place for blood products for those shorter transports?
Yeah, I do. I think pretty much since you left, we had just kicked off, I think, when you were here, the King County and Seattle Fire Department whole blood program. So we've been looking at this pretty intently. That was the big criticism of folks levied towards the Seattle Fire Department for initiating sort of a whole blood transfusion program. On the ground side of things, it's a small urban city with really fast transport times. You know, we're rarely more than 20 minutes by ground away from Harborview. What is the time saved here? And we've been looking at this, and even for patients that are injured right downtown, which is a substantial portion of the patients, a lot of our penetrating trauma here in Seattle, either our stabbings or shootings, which we get a lot of shootings because it's America, in the 2020s. But a lot of these patients are 5 minutes or less from Harborview, and they're still getting blood products when we compare them to previous patients, on average 10 to 15 minutes faster, even if they get blood products on the ramp at Harborview from EMS, just because it's just not that simple, right? When you walk in, there's a handoff that has to happen. The patient has to get moved over to the hospital gurney. Access has to be insured. You've got to get the blood prepped. It has to be checked by the hospital staff. The level one transfuser has to get set up. It just takes time. So sometimes it's faster than others. And on some cases, when we have pre-notification, obviously the hospital can be ready. But even when they're right there, we're looking at 15, 20 minutes faster transfusion, blood into patient, if it's initiated in the pre-hospital setting. So now outcomes on that, we're looking on it. We have transfused over 100 patients this last fall in the city of Seattle, and we've got more in the county. So we're trying to get a large enough sample size to really start looking at outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, most of the literature on whole blood, especially like that, is basically like in the military, and you know, not the most like robust research environment to actually get reliable data from, but you know, the data at least from the military setting has been positive as far as things like outcomes and coagulopathy. So really trying to do this in the civilian setting is kind of a challenging thing to do, which we're trying to do now with this randomized control style trial. And one reason why we didn't include ground in the 2R study was because they already carry whole blood, so having them carry component therapy just didn't make a whole lot of sense. Since this is already part of their protocol to carry the whole blood, and the hypothesis is whole blood is maybe more beneficial for these patients. That's the hypothesis, at least as far as looking at, you know, mortality within 30 days and then overall mortality.
Okay. Logistics wise, for those ground transportation whole blood units, should we look at it as every medic unit in the county carries a credo box, or how does that work?
That was a big debate.
I was going to say,
it's still up for debate, maybe even in South King County for the resident.
Cutting open all these sore wounds.
Yeah. So I think pretty much all of the ALS agencies in King County, of which there are five. So for those listening in, King County has about 2.8 million people live in King County, and there's five ALS agencies that service this area, Seattle being one of them. All of these agencies, to my knowledge, are really using an MSO intercept model. So MSO being a medical staff officer, medic supervising officer. So in the case of Seattle Fire, we actually have these supervising paramedics. Some places will call them APPs, maybe in Western Europe or in the UK, sort of that model in a sense. They in Seattle are actually based at the level one, the major trauma center, where the blood bank is, which helps keep the credo boxes up, keeps the blood product cycle very easy because they can just walk downstairs and exchange it once a week. But they'll just throw it in the car and they'll respond as sort of an extra paramedic to these scenes. They already get dispatched to major trauma scenes, so they're there anyway. And some of these other fringe cases, the paramedics are getting much better at calling for intercept, and they'll essentially meet halfway. Occasionally that's on the freeway. They'll literally hop out of their rig, leave it on the side of the freeway, hop in the back of the medic unit, and they'll keep rolling towards the hospital. The idea is to not delay at a hospital, prolong at a hospital time. It's a bigger challenge when you have a more geographically spread out area. So South King County, the southern parts of the county, covers a lot of square miles, square kilometers. And so covering that is a little bit more of a challenge. So I think there are definitely some patients that really aren't in the radius of usefulness of this intercept model. And actually, some of these fringe areas still use the helicopter. So they'll call the helicopter, they'll call airlift to get to these outer bounds areas, and we'll deliver the blood product that way. So it's sort of a mix.
Right. Yeah, because South King County, sort of like prior to them getting blood, even now because of how big it is, a lot of times they'll utilize the helicopter because, you know, their MSO is so far away. And, you know, at that point where that line is sort of kind of depends. But then they'll use, you know, the helicopter to actually, they know that we have blood products in every transport that will just start transfusing when we get there, kind of thing.
Now, if we had something that was shelf stable, that was something lyophilized, say.
Right.
Something that's freeze-dried.
Freeze-dried, yeah.
Then maybe you could put it in all the ambulances.
Yeah.
But not currently FDA approved in the United States because we're still in the 1970s here.
For various reasons, yeah.
I know the Belgian military stocks it. So far, our blood banks do not, but we have a means of getting it, so could be a good idea for our system. Another thing we may have forgotten to mention is that the helicopters obviously are equipped with blood warmers that are very mobile, are lightweight, easy to use. What's that like for the medic units?
They use the same device. They're currently using the same
Q-Inflow.
Q-Inflow. Again, we don't have any conflicts with this particular company.
Correct.
But the Q-Inflow Warrior, it's an Israeli company. They've actually got some new model. We've got sort of the old.
The Q-Inflow Lite, I believe it's called, I think just got FDA approved in December. So it's a little bit smaller than what we have now.
It's pretty impressive. There's a variety of these on the market. They're all pretty good. It's just based on cost and form factor, I think. This particular one worked pretty well.
We haven't broken one yet.
Yeah,
which is huge.
It's kind of idiot-proof. Yeah, our paramedics haven't either. So we carry the warmer with the blood intercept unit, and then we've ended up actually putting blood prime tubing on all the medic units so that when they know they call them blood runs happening, the medics can actually prime the blood tubing, get it all set up,
before and then essentially rendezvous.
Yeah, before the rendezvous, right. So that all they have to do is insert this essentially, it's like a foam piece into the circuit and then plug it in and go. But the device works pretty well, I think. And the one we use allows, you can transfuse a liter in less than 2 minutes
it's
of
like
warm product.
200 cc's a minute, basically, and with a constant temp of like, you know, above body temp, basically. So
right.
You can transfuse like almost, you know, pressure bag that much in, and it'll still be like really, really warm. Like,
and this is directly from the cooler.
Yeah.
When the product's directly from the cooler. Yeah. So I think it works. I think it works pretty well.
Yeah. Is there any other feedback you've received from the flight nurses or the medics working with the pre-hospital blood protocol with the devices?
As far as the warming device?
Just anything, the whole logistics operation, the way to work with it. Are they happy to do it that way? Do you feel like there's benefits for their patients?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like sort of prior to actually, you know, having blood products, you know, there was sort of like that feeling of helplessness where you know what the patient needs and you just can't give it.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, once we sort of overcame those logistical barriers, like we feel like there definitely is benefit to that, you know. You know, granted, the way that we carry it in the Credo box, it's not the lightest thing in the world. I can't remember how many pounds it is, like 15 pounds or so. So there is definitely that. And then the blood warmers themselves, the one that we use, the Q and Flow, works great. We actually have it mounted, as you know, Cedric,
yeah.
in the back in the
inside of the helicopter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's
perfect head strike.
Exactly. So it's, you know, as far as the weight of it, you know, like taking it to like a remote scene, it's a little more challenging. It's a little bit of a heavier sort of device. So there is some, you know, chat about that. Like if you're actually going to have to, you know, prolonged extrication or somewhere that's further away, that you're further away from the aircraft, you may have to do with transfusing cold product if mm-hmm. it ends up being that way, since we actually have our warmers actually mounted in aircraft. So there's right. that.
Okay. I have another question for you, because in Belgium, you mentioned K-Centra and PPSB. What about fibrinogen? Because you guys use cryoprecipitate.
In the hospital, yeah.
Yeah. Because we have fibrinogen that we can take on our rigs or our medic units. Do you think that'd be useful to give in a pre-hospital setting?
I'm not super familiar with the literature on it for resuscitation with hemorrhage
mm-hmm.
isolated. I know there's not any, at least, American pre-hospital literature on it.
Yeah.
I know that there was some funding locally for a four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate research trial that...
out of OHSU.
That we locally were likely to participate in on the ground side. I don't know where that is. I'm not personally involved in that. I think the logistics of at least the four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate are pretty complicated. The dosing and... You know,
the mixing
of it is a challenge. I think that's not to be underestimated, especially when you have all these other tasks on these. You know, these are by definition like the sickest patients you see that the pre-hospital providers are seeing. I guess so. I don't know entirely how that would be dosed. Is it weight-based dose? The fibrinogen concentrate would be
the vials are 1 gram or 1.5 gram. We usually give one at a time. Unless we can measure it, then we can dose it. But in a pre-hospital setting, it would be very hard to, you know, take on a TEG device in your rig,
or right?
It becomes super hard. So I don't think anyone's planning on doing that. But technically, as far as I know, no one's using it in a pre-hospital setting. But it may be one of those therapies that we can bring to the patient, since liquid plasma is so hard to come by in Europe. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I think
for the whole fibrinolysis and trauma.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely makes some. Sort of, I guess, biologic sense, and kind of as Latimer was saying, there was some efforts in kind of locally to actually look at this, and yeah, the study looking at PCC sort of pre-hospital, or the feasibility study, is sort of ongoing. So I think, you know, there's, in light of not having product, there's probably enough sort of evidence that it's worth looking at, which is kind of why they're looking at sort of pre-hospital PCC. So that might be a bridge until you kind of get there. I think the logistical issues of it, cost of the medication, but also, yeah, like the as Latimer put it, kind of like the logistical issues of mixing this up. That's what scared a lot of people away from it. I think was like, I got to do this on a level space. You know, can you be as clean as you can while doing it? And it's just in the pre-hospital environment, it's really challenging.
I wonder what it's like to mix up fibrinogen in a helicopter, because if it starts to shake. it turns into foam.
I was going to say, foam, right? Yeah.
That's a problem with the K-Centra as well, with the four-factor prothrombin complex concentrates, with the sort of sampling that they had done with that. Yeah, it'll be interesting. One of the things they're doing with the two-war trial that we're part of, the whole blood versus component therapy, they're actually getting TEGs within an hour of arrival and then at 24 hours on all the patients. It's one of the secondary outcomes. So it'll be really interesting. I know they have a bunch of sort of pre-planned secondary analysis to do on this study. So we'll see. You know, maybe it is that fibrinolysis is a big part of it. I don't think anyone really knows with these patients.
Right.
So
yeah, it's very interesting.
We'll have sort of at least an observational sense for what's going on in some of these patients. We don't routinely do thromboelastography at Harborview anymore.
Yeah, I think when you were here, were they doing it?
No, they weren't. And I think to clarify for our listeners, the standard coagulation assays at Harborview come back really quickly.
Right.
Even more so than one of the big studies that compared thromboelastometry to conventional coagulation assays. Because they take like what, 15 minutes to come back?
Oh yeah, the hemorrhage panel comes back probably in that time frame, probably
or less.
Or less. It's basically like you're still in the resus bay, and someone comes in with the results already while you're still working on the patient.
They essentially call it up, and then a runner comes in the room. I mean, it's quick.
So it's kind of like in light of that, you're like, I think that's probably why we've abandoned it from a practicality perspective at Harborview is because we have this other way to get the information.
You get your fibrinogen levels.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the main motivators why we use it, is it's the test that gives us information the quickest.
Right.
But I think if your conventional coagulation assay comes back within 15 minutes, probably as useful, I would say.
Yeah, and that's usually right about when you're adding on your platelets and your cryo.
Yeah, like,
if you don't have whole blood, that's about the right time that's happening, right?
Exactly.
It's interesting. I'm sort of a whole blood fanboy. I don't know what the whole blood situation's like in Belgium.
Well, like with liquid plasma, it's very hard to come by. I don't know many centers that are using it currently, but we haven't seen it around. So
I heard from our Dr. Hess, who's the director of our blood transfusion service, and who has a long history with U.S. Army, working with Holcomb on some of the original blood studies out of shock trauma in Maryland. He's a big fan of pre-hospital transfusion, and he comes up to the ER wandering around frequently, and I know at the end of January they had like 110 units of whole blood been used that like were going to expire in the next couple of weeks, and we had a surplus of whole blood, which is
wow. and like when people ask how do you get this started, like it comes down to the transfusion services that are at your facility. And whenever people ask how did this get developed, and it's a relationship you have with transfusion services, and because Dr. Hess is the director and he's very much a proponent, things happen. If you don't have that relationship, or you have someone in that position that is reluctant to, it's just not going to get off the ground. That's just kind of how it really is. So we're very fortunate, I think, the fact that we have someone who is very forward-thinking in this, because it's virtually impossible if you don't have that type of relationship.
All right, so obviously in Belgium we have a government-sponsored healthcare system, so one of the things to take into account implementing new stuff in your system is the cost. Do you guys have any idea on what the economics are behind an operation for blood transfusion in a helicopter?
Yeah, absolutely. So we looked at this after the first sort of 6 years of going sort of full program wide with blood. So the first 6 years of our regional program, we looked at the economics of this. I think this is of great interest. I actually published a manuscript in Transfusion. This was back in, 2021, looks like. And in this manuscript, we described sort of that first 6 years. We ended up using 7,400 units of blood that got cycled through the program. Mm-hmm. Over 1,000 units got transfused. We ended up transfusing 57% of the units transfused were plasma. So we have a kind of yellows before reds policy. So our crews will give a unit of plasma, then a unit of packed red blood cells, and a 1-to-1 ratio starting with plasma. So the nurses followed that. Most of the crews followed that. We had a less than 3% loss or waste of the product. So it either got transfused or got returned. And when you divide the total cost of the program over the flights during that six-year period, it cost us $63 per patient to have four units of product available. So pretty cost-effective,
yeah,
I think.
It's very economical.
Hard to argue against. Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Well, I think that's pretty much all of my questions. Thank you guys for taking the time talking to me. Great to see you both again. And yeah, hopefully in a couple of years, we'll have some other innovative stuff to talk about.
Awesome.
Sounds good.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, bye.
Zo, dat besluit alweer een extra aflevering van onze Spoedcast. Willen jullie meer van dit soort afleveringen aan bod zien komen? Als extra content, waarbij dat we toch enkele experts uit het vakgebied aan het woord laten, laat het ons gerust weten via onze sociale mediakanalen of via e-mail en we bekijken het graag voor jullie verder. Bedankt voor het luisteren en tot volgende keer.